Call the Center Resources Committee, April 19th, to order. Members present, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator Seekins, Senator Elton, Senator Kukash, Senator Dyson, and myself, Senator Wagoner. We have two bills today to hear. One is Senate Bill 278. We had the bill presented last time by Senator Olson. This time, I'd like to have Senator Olson come back and see if there's anything else he wanted to present to the committee on his bill. And we'll hear from testimony. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's certainly good to be back in front of you again, especially considering the alternative. But today, I'd like to go ahead and just continue on after I give the presentation on Senate Bill 278, which establishes a task force to look at some of the changes climatologically that have been going on over a period of time, and to go ahead and see what the real implications are, and to go ahead and come for this task force to come up with a recommendation as to whether it's something that should be taken seriously, or whether it's something that can be let off to a different time. This afternoon, we have a number of people that would like to testify on the bill. These are people that have been contacted and have expertise in different areas, as was pointed out by the bill. We had four people that were up there: Dr. Glenn Patrick Jude, Brian Davies, Dr. Roland Ma, and John Shively. Unfortunately, John Shively is on a flight now and is not going to be able to make it, but I would like to go ahead and present, or like to introduce you to these three people and have them go ahead and testify as to the appropriateness of this bill. The first one is Dr. Glenn Patrick Jude, who is a professor of forest ecology and forest sciences at the department at the University of Alaska there in Fairbanks. Dr. Jude was the lead author for the Arctic Climate Impacts Assessment Chapter on Forestry. He has taught at the university for over 20 years and has published a long list of scientific articles on the impacts of climate change on forest resources in Alaska and in the Arctic in general. With that, Dr. Jude, please.
Are you on there, Dr. Jude?
Okay, am I connected now?
Yeah, go ahead. We hear you fine.
All right. Well, I was told you wanted it short, 5 minutes, so here are five questions and five answers in 5 minutes. First question, is it really warmer in Alaska? Answer is yes. Okay, then how much? Well, that depends on where you are, which season you're looking at. It's warm a little faster in the winter than it has in the summer, et cetera, and what times you want to compare. But the standard way of tracking these things by the National Weather Service is the last 30 years that cover complete decades. So we'd say 1971 through 2000, what's the 30-year trend? In most stations in Alaska, it's up about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit. The strongest warming is over 4 degrees at Barrow. Okay, second question, what's making Alaska warmer, and well, the world in general? What drives the temperatures on the planet are solar variability, volcanoes, greenhouse gases, and a new thing we know now, it's called global dimming, or shading from pollution. In Alaska, we're particularly affected by ocean currents, and especially El Niños. They deliver heat to us. They've been more frequent, they've been stronger, and they've lasted longer. And we're a lot warmer as a result. Third question, is the warming affecting anything in Alaska that we might care about? And the answer is yes, and it's a long list. You took all the glaciers in Alaska, they've lost about 50, the average loss of all glaciers all over Alaska, about 50 feet of water. The Arctic sea ice is at a record minimum extent. There are ice-free passages now in the summer, and it's well on track to be completely gone at the end of the summer within a couple of decades. maybe three, four decades. Lakes are drying, river low flow episodes are more common, and river temperatures are up. Permafrost is warming, some of it is thawing. Trees are growing less because they're running out of water. Forest fires and insects that are warm weather phenomena are more common and are affecting more forests. Fourth question, will it continue to get warmer? The best scientific evidence is if we stopped all greenhouse gases emissions right now, we'd have 50 to 70 years of additional strong warming. If greenhouse gas emissions continue to accelerate, well, there's just a straight line relationship between how much more warming we'll get. Fifth question, how do we know we can trust the people who are telling us all of this? Well, I point you to an article I just wrote for our magazine at the School of Natural Resources called Agriborealis. And I took the results of a 1982 conference, national level conference, that we had here in Alaska on the possibility of climate warming and took the predictions from it and then just compared it to what's actually happened in 2006, a 24-year update. Right on target on virtually everything that I cited. Well, bottom line then is a sixth question, what to do about it? It seems to me that getting our heads together, planning, getting the people with the information together with the people who need to know would be a reasonable thing to do. And as I understand it, that's what this bill does, and sounds like a good plan to me.
That the end, Dr. Jadeh?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? Senator Stedman?
Kind of a comment. Ice ages come and go, but one thing I find is kind of interesting is last year in Ketchikan, the town of Buck, got washed into the ocean with record rainfall. So we, at least in southeast, I don't think are, you know, we're facing drought conditions.
Yes, I think it's important to, it's difficult to boil things down, you know, for a presentation like this and get all of the exceptions and nuances. But in general, as a principle, when you affect the Earth climate system in a measurable way and start changing things, you get sometimes opposite changes in different places. So the steering currents that bring the storms ashore have not been going to certain places, and that's most of the landmass of Alaska, and they have been going more frequently and more intensely through other places in Alaska.
Thank you. Additional questions?
No, just one.
Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Judy, where was global warming this winter in January in Fairbanks?
Well, we had a in general, we've been experiencing a very, very much warmer Arctic Ocean basin on the planet for the last, well, 2-3 years. That process was really accelerated in January, all kinds of warm air coming into the Arctic, and some of it had to go out somewhere, and that somewhere was right over us. So that's why it was colder. The Arctic Ocean sea ice has set a minimum record each month for about the last year, and we're well on track to have another record meltback of the sea ice.
I was home this weekend, Mr. Chairman, and it was 1 degree above zero on the 15th of April at my house. I've never experienced that before, but I would just as a comment. Thank you.
Any further questions of Dr. Jude? Thank you, Doctor, for your testimony.
Well, thank you.
I have one question.
Oh,
excuse me.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I, Dr. Jude, maybe you just clarified this, really a question. Were you in the end of a glaciation? I've heard some scientific information saying that we're at the end of a glaciation period now. Is that your analysis?
Okay, now, it depends on the time frame you want to look at, but...
Well, that relates to the next question, is when did that glaciation that we're at the end of, when did that period start?
About a million years ago. Yeah. And
this is the Wisconsin glaciation?
Right. Well, no, there were four major episodes. The most recent one was the Wisconsin, and that began about 70,000 years ago, reached a peak about 35,000 years ago, and ended pretty definitively about 12,500 years ago.
And so the glaciers that exist in around Alaska are the remnants of that ended 20,000 years ago it ended?
12,500. Well, yes and no. The ice in them isn't that old. It's continually renewed. And there have been warming episodes, cooling episodes back and forth, but in general, yeah, I mean, the portion of the land surface covered with ice was much greater during the Ice Age. It's now much, much smaller. If it gets a whole lot warmer, it'll get a whole lot smaller, yes.
And again, if I might, Mr. Chairman, just for information, you said that, so we're at the end of the fourth one, and it began about, what you said, 70,000 years ago. What were the dates of the other three? Just out of curiosity.
I don't recall all of them offhand. I know their names. There's Nebraska and Kansas and Illinois and Wisconsin. If you follow the terminology that's used on land, the terminology for the evidence from sea cores is different, and is as far as the exact dating, I can't give that to you right offhand.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't recall. I do remember that the other Wisconsin glaciation. Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Thank you, sir. It has been represented to me by some weather scientists that the thickness of the ice pack in Antarctica has been increasing, and some of it in, I believe, Greenland, even though there's been some chunks broke off the coastal ice in Antarctica. Are there glaciers and ice fields on the globe that are increasing in size at this time?
There are a few in Alaska. And then a couple of other places, but they represent a very, very distinct minority of all the world's glaciers. In general, they're characterized by having their gathering areas up high in elevation, so that the main effect of the warming that we have experienced is to simply increase the snowfall that occurs in those high elevation areas. As far as Greenland, their most recent research, the last 4 years of observation, show it's collapsing much faster than was ever anticipated, and is now, it looks inevitable at the current temperatures, let alone additional warming, that it will substantially increase sea level. In Antarctica, the ice has, we have a fairly short record. In that short record, up until about 2003, it was not possible to confirm a shrinking trend. Since then, it is possible, and so there's some very substantial ice loss occurring there too.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Thank you very much. Next, we'll go to Dr. Roland Ma.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Ma has been the executive director of the United Cook Inlet Drifter Association. Dr. Ma is a commercial fisherman in Cook Inlet and a tender operator in Kenai. With that, Dr. Ma, please.
Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and fellow senators, this is Roland Ma. As indicated, I'm the current executive director for USEDA. Just a couple of little notes. My bachelor's degree is in ecology, and my master's degree was in wildlife management. My PhD is also in forestry, but my current employment and issues revolve around fisheries. And I certainly support everything the prior speaker gave to you. Just a couple of insights as to why this is a good idea. Knowing the geography of the Kenai Peninsula borough, that we're almost totally surrounded by marine ecosystems, except for that little piece of land up by Portage Glacier. And in looking at what's going on around the world, and certainly with those Greenland and the Antarctic ice caps, there are various models out there that predict rising sea levels. But I think it's a pretty safe bet that over the next probably three decades or thereabouts, we're going to see about a 10-foot rise in sea levels if the models are close to being accurate. For us in the fishing industry, that would have huge monumental effects on estuaries and probably the loss of those nursery areas for salmon and other species. But certainly in terms of all the erosion that's going to go along from all the way from Nikiski all the way down to Homer, the effect of erosion now of having a much higher elevated sea level working directly on those banks pretty well all the time as compared to only at high tides. And then all of the infrastructures that we rely on in the fishing industry for loading and offloading of our products, those are some issues that I think are worthy of having a look at, and I think this this commission is a good vehicle for doing that. The other little insight is that some of you know that we're having some problems with the salmon returns up in the Mat-Su Valley. And in talking with the folks down at Fishing Game, it looks like not only seeing smaller stream flows up there, but perhaps just as critical as we're seeing the summer temperatures and the water in some of those streams are getting to lethal temperatures for both the adults and for the out-migrating smolt. And so even though the ocean environment and other environments may be fine, we've got this bottleneck of these smaller streams getting into these lakes, and we're seeing fish dying in some of those areas. The other thing we saw last summer for the first time up there in the Mat-Su was we saw some of the lakes actually having what we call an anoxic condition, and that means after about 2 or 3 meters of depth, they say 10 feet or thereabouts, the whole bottom water part of the lake, the whole bottom part of that water column had no available oxygen at all, and that was due to both not only the warming of the temperature and increased aquatic vegetation activity, but that vegetation subsequently dying and rotting and soaking up the available oxygen. And of course, if you're a little salmon trying to make a living in there, and as the sunlight comes out, you want to go to deeper waters to avoid the predators, why, you go right into these anoxic layers, and mortality starts to happen pretty quickly. Say we saw that up there this summer for the first time. So anyway, I think having a look at the effect of rising sea levels on all kinds of infrastructures, as well as erosion, as well as the natural and ecology of this area and other areas of Alaska as well. It's just going to be just something to the Kenai. 10-foot rise in sea levels would have drastic effects, I would think, over in Bristol Bay. And the only other comment I would make is that in the Senate bill that's in front of you, looking at the makeup of the committee,
I'm sure it's always a bit of a struggle for you, but I don't see any sort of industry representatives there. I see lots of government and university people there. But anyway, you might just give some consideration, if you would, please, to having somebody from, you know, one of the major industries that are directly relying on the water and some of these effects that will be coming because of global warming. And I'm not particularly interested in doing any kind of a he said, she said as to why it's happening. I agree with the former speaker. It's happening. It's going to be happening for the next probably half century, even if we stop some of the activities now. But we do have to deal with it. And I'll conclude there, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions of Dr. Ma? Senator Stebbins?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm just kind of curious on the Kenai, if there's tectonic rebound going on up there, like there is in Southeast Alaska, where we have, over the last century, gained quite a bit of land, especially in the northern part of Southeast, in and around Juneau and northern Chichikov and northern Admiralty.
Through the chairman, I've not specifically looked at that, so I don't know.
Further questions? Thank you for the testimony, Dr. Ma. I think the last person we have to testify is Brian Davies.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Obviously, in Alaska, one of the main concerns we have is the effect that this warming trend is going to have on our economy, specifically the lifeline for Alaska, which is the pipeline and the infrastructure that's involved. From industry, we have Brian Davies, who's the former chief of BP operations up at Prudhoe. Mr. Davies has worked for BP for over 30 years as an engineer and as an operations manager. With that, Mr. Davies, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I've spent most of the last 35 years in Alaska. There were 9 years while I was exiled to other places, but always came back. And over those 35 years, I have noticed a very distinct change in the climate. I think we need to not confuse weather with climate. But clearly there has been a distinct warming phase. And as you've heard from previous speakers, you know, that's a warming phase which is global, but it just so happens that here in Alaska, we're at the leading edge of that. It seems that in Alaska, we're experiencing somewhere between 2 and 4 times the global average. So not again, I don't want to talk about what might be causing this. The trend is very, very clear, and it seems as if we can expect that trend to continue. I think it would be imprudent of us not to plan for that continued trend. Already you've heard of some examples of how this warming trend is impacting the resources of the state. There's economic and social impacts of this, and we can, if these are likely to be significant on forestry, on marine shoreline, on fishing, on natural resource development, and on the infrastructure of our towns and villages. So with this very clearly established trend and this expectation that the trend is likely to continue, I fully support the concept of the establishment of this broad-based temporary commission to pull together the information of how this trend is affecting Alaska and how it could affect Alaska in the future, and to develop a business plan to deal with the challenges of this trend and hopefully identify some opportunities. Maybe we'll be able to grow pineapples at some stage, but clearly this is something that as a businessman, we should take note of and plan to deal with it. And that's all that we're asking for here, is the establishment of a vehicle to start planning for the eventualities. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a question of Mr. Davies? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, that's all the witnesses we have planned for this afternoon.
Okay.
Glad to entertain any other questions if there are for the committee.
Just make sure there's nobody here in the audience who wishes to testify. I don't see anybody. Are there any other questions of the sponsor? Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions for the sponsor. On line 2, on page 2, it says the task force consists of 13 members, but then you've delineated that 4 of those are ex officio, or meaning by their position in the department, they also will be voting members of your task force?
That's correct. That, to the best of my knowledge, is correct, but it doesn't have to necessarily be that way.
Yeah. I'll just curious. Secondly, why do we have a dedicated seat for the Alaska Conservation Alliance? What do they bring in terms of scientific expertise to the table?
I think that the Alaska Conservation Alliance certainly has personnel in there that have a perspective, if not expertise, that may be helpful to the task force, but that particular person or all the members here are appointed both by the Senate President and the Speaker, and I think that those personalities have the good judgment to go ahead and decide who's going to be on there.
Doesn't the it's inferred then that the Speaker, that the President or the Speaker name them?
If you look at
jointly, but why would that? Who is the Alaska Conservation Alliance?
The Alaska Conservation Alliance is a group of people who have shown an interest in general conservation ideas and have got a group of them that talks about things such as this.
Don't they pretty much have a pre-established position?
I'm not sure that that's the case. They may in some people's views, but I think that as I pointed out earlier, up on line 3, or line 2 starts at line 2, these people that are on the task force are appointed by the Senate President, and line 5 shows they're appointed by the Speaker, and I'm deferring to their good judgment as to who these members are going to be.
And next question, if I could, Senator Mr. Seekins. Chairman. While it appears to me, and maybe I'm not wrong, that you're primarily concerned with the warming trends in the Arctic and subarctic, but this part of the state really isn't subarctic. Are we looking at, is it primarily to look at the effects in the northern regions of the state, or is it more than that?
It's primary to look at, obviously, all people within the state are concerned about what's going on, as was pointed out by one of the earlier committee members down here with the tectonic rebound that is going on. We're dealing with somewhat a different set of circumstances with a different effect. But I think throughout the state of Alaska, we are going to see climatological effects and a trend that's been clearly shown, and as was pointed out by the previous speaker or witness, that to not plan for these trends would be imprudent. And that's what this commission is here to do without a preconceived bias toward what's going on. We don't want to see that. We want to know if indeed there is something that's happened and have recommendations to go ahead and meet the changes that we see coming on.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman,
Seekins.
How do you propose that the selection of a chairperson take place from any one of the 13 appointees?
They're all eligible. Any one of the 13 appointees certainly are eligible, but I would say that the task force that has been appointed many times are going to be the ones that decide who the chairperson is going to be.
Most of the task forces I've been on, it's been a member of the legislature that's chaired it. I just curious if that was the intent or if it was thrown open to everyone, including a member of the Alaska Conservation Alliance.
I would say that we'd be depending on the good judgment of the Senate President and the Speaker of the House to make sure that the chairperson is a well-qualified person for this task force.
That's the only questions I had at this time.
If I could be so bold as to make a recommendation that the committee select, if he's sitting there, Senator Donnie Olson, the chair.
Trying to kill the bill?
Kill the messenger.
Kill the bill. Huh? I guess, Mr. Chairman, my comment is, if it is a committee, I guess I would look more at making sure that it was a member that chaired it in terms of selecting a chairperson. While I applaud the attempt to make sure that we have an equally balanced majority member, minority member legislative delegation, I guess I would be more interested in trying to take a look at members who had some particular interest in the subject of global warming and economic planning. But definitely it would be my preference if chairperson was a member.
I would think that would be up to the Senate President and the Speaker to make sure that happened. Senator Elton?
Well, Mr. Chair, the way I understand it is the task force itself selects the right chair. I don't necessarily disagree with Senator Seekins, I do think that if the task force is going to select the chair, we ought to let the task force select from amongst the members. I would note that if, in fact, there's a predisposition towards selecting a member, four of the members of this task force happen to be members of the legislature and would constitute a fairly significant block if, in fact, they wanted to make that happen.
Any other questions? Chair to entertain a motion to move the bill at this time.
Actually, I'd prefer to. Where does it go next, Mr. Chairman?
Finance.
I'd like to amend the part of the bill if I could.
We'll offer an amendment.
I'd like to offer an amendment on line 23, page 2, that select a chairperson from among the members of the legislature.
I object, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to speak to your objection?
Well, just very brief. Just very briefly. For one thing, I think it's an interesting dynamic in getting going. If the task force, is told select a chair and is not restricted, to a certain group on the task force from which they can select a chair. The other reason I would object is more procedural or process wise. I mean, my expectation is that this bill is going to meet up with the House bill in the next committee, and that in fact it may be best to leave the that kind of a decision to the next committee where it's meeting the House bill. I suspect the House bill is going to be the vehicle.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still a legislator in full dress uniform and have a vote, and I'm not willing to pass that on to the next committee. I would like to make sure that this task force, and I'm not trying to be parochial, but I do believe that as a legislative task force to bring a report, that it should be a member of the legislature who chairs the process, and that way I'm assured that there is a greater input in terms of the selection of the chairperson by the president and the Speaker of the House, who say, any one of these four people are qualified to be, chair of the committee. Now, in some cases on task forces, we've specified that the president name or the, speaker name the chairperson, but I just feel like a member should chair that. And I'm just, for sake of expediency to the next committee, I've never known my colleague to do that himself before. It's a new page of the book here, so, okay.
Further discussion? Senator Duquette?
If we have a chairman who is the member of the legislature, does that help in any way with the funding of this task force? I don't see any money in a fiscal note, and I'm just wondering how that would work. Is it easier to get this committee to meet if you have a member of the legislature who's a chairman? I don't know.
I think that's going to be up to the Senate President and the Speaker of the House to determine what funds are set aside for their use. And it might well, in fact, affect their willingness to fund it if there is.
Just to follow up, that's my point. You know, if there's a chance we can get some support from the Senate or the House on making sure this task force work goes forward, and if it helps to have the chairman be a member of the body, either body, I'd be willing to support it.
But there are some fairly substantial fiscal notes for the task force that are attached. I don't know if you've seen them. $112,000 from Legislative Affairs. And
okay.
$5,000 from this commissioner, $5,000 from that commissioner, $5,000. So there's $140,000 at least in the fiscal notes that I see, Mr. Chairman, at the moment. Yeah.
Okay, drops down.
And I,
that's why it's got to go to finance.
Right.
Bert, Bert and Fred. And the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, if you'd like, I'd be glad to go ahead and comment on the finance, on the fiscal note, if you'd like me to. Or we can continue on with the discussion that was going on there before.
No, go ahead.
Certainly, finance is one of those things that is very foremost in those of us that are fiscally responsible for the state. As I looked at the financial, at the fiscal note, I was somewhat taken aback by the numbers that were presented as well. In looking at what's there, though, I see that the biggest ticket item that is on for $68,000 is the personal services, which I found could certainly be eliminated, if not cut down significantly. The travel, obviously, is one thing we want to make sure that is still available to make sure that all people can go ahead and be part of. So to a certain degree, the fiscal note can be put into more appropriate number.
Okay. Well, I'm sure finance will take a look at that when it gets up there. That's where it goes next. Right now, currently, though, we're kind of getting off the track. What we have in front of us is a proposed amendment to the bill on line 23. Page 2. For further discussion on the amendment?
Well, I'd like to know Senator what the sponsor Kukash thinks of the amendment. I mean, he's sitting right in front of us. We could ask him.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kukish, I looked at the possibility that this may be a contentious point, and realizing that there are people out there with more expertise and less vocalization, as well as people that are not experts and like to talk. And so I have remained open to who that chairperson might be. And so at least at this point, I can defer to the committee for their ideas that's there, or else we can even deal with it at the next committee that's referral.
Senator Seegans.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I look at the total over the time frame of the fiscal notes that are presented, they're in the range of a quarter of $1 million. Part of the chairman's responsibility is to administer the expense
budget.
Of the budget. It just seems to me that that should be a member of the legislature who has that responsibility. The chairperson, other than that, can, you know, is to bring order to the process, not necessarily to dominate the result. And so I don't see that we are threatening the result in any respect, the result or the findings of a task force based on who is keeping order in the process and taking care of the budget.
Senator Elton?
Well, I just would raise another point. I mean, one of the important duties of this task force is to come back to the legislature and say, hey, here's what we think is going on. Here are the issues you need to think about, whether it's shortened drilling seasons on the North Slope or whether it's permafrost damage to airports or roadways. It just seems to me that one of the most important decisions they're going to make initially is who is going to be the chair. And I would just caution that one of the things that happens, and we deal with it all the time, is that as members of the legislature, people will say, well, of course, you know, he or she is going to say that because they're conservative or liberal, or they're from Southeast, or they're from the North Slope. I just tend to think that some of those filters go away if the task force is able to pick and choose from amongst 13 people rather than amongst 4 people. And I think that there may be filters that disappear if it is somebody that has more of a policy background, maybe from the university, and there are filters that may appear if it happens to be an elected official. So I maintain my objection.
I just have to make one comment. There are very few people at the university level that do that much budgeting other than department chairs, et cetera. So I'd be somewhat hesitant on that. Senator Kukesh.
I just want to, I guess, state my position. I don't think I can support this. I'm not in a legislator because I'm smart. I'm in a legislator because I ran a good race.
And I would
be hesitant to think that I would have to say that there aren't people out there who could be a better chairman than I just because I'm in a legislature. I'm uncomfortable with that. I mean, if we had it as established practice, I'd probably feel a little bit better about it, but we don't. And I think if you have 13 people, some of them with academic backgrounds, I think that we ought to give them a chance to pick from among themselves. Some good people out there, and not all of them are in the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say one thing as chairman. In a way, I see both sides of the arguments, but on the other hand, as a senator, the person who's been elected by the people, the one thing they elect you for is to control funds. And I think a legislature, in most cases, would be more conservative and control the funds better than turning it over to a member. I think I'd have a little more comfort in that. And you're right, there are some very bright people out there, and hopefully we get a lot of those people on this commission if we establish it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those same people are good stewards of the state's money. And I think in that case, I think it is good to have a legislator at least controlling the budget end of it. And so I just Senator Stebbins.
Well, I was just going to say, Mr. Chairman, I thought that Senator Kukesh had a PhD in jurisprudence. Is that correct?
I haven't been able to convince any of you in it, so I don't know. I don't know. It's a very good degree. It hasn't worked for you guys.
Call the question.
I was going to say, I think we're getting beyond the point of where we should be. You maintain your objection?
I do.
Take the roll, please.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Stedman?
Yes.
Senator Elton?
No.
Senator Kukesh?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
Senator Webb?
Yes. Okay, now I have in front of you Senate Bill 278 is amended. So wishes the committee.
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chairman. We pass Senate Bill 278, Version A, as amended, from committee. Individual recommendations.
Is there any objection?
And attached fiscal note.
Okay. Bill moved. Finance. Let's go off record. Come back to order. We were going to hear two bills today. Because of time constraints, we won't be hearing Senate Joint Resolution 17. We're going to put that on the docket for Monday, at Monday's meeting. And due to time constraints, we're going to proceed now with the Agrium presentation on Cook Inlet oil and gas and transition. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Boycott.
Thank you very much, Senator. First, I'd just like to say thank you for your time. We certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I don't want to plow through a lot of old ground, but I'll give you just a brief overview of our facility, just on the ensure everybody's familiar. That the picture here gives an idea of the complex that we've got there in Kenai. It's a complex that was built to convert natural gas to anhydrous ammonia and urea products, basically for use in agricultural and petrochemical applications. It is the second largest nitrogen complex in the United States, largest processing complex in Alaska. In the last few years, we've faced significant challenges that we'll get into later, but just really right now I want to talk about the business overall. You can see that some of our product is used in Alaska. It's I think around 2% of our product is used in Alaska, the all of the runway de-icer, Fairbanks and Anchorage, the Arctic melt that you use on your driveway, the fertilizer that goes into the valley and up into Delta is product out of our complex. The majority of our product is going to export markets, and you can see there, obviously with deep water, we've got excellent access into the Pacific Rim. The anhydrous ammonia from our plant is going primarily into the South Korea market, and the urea is going into South Korea, Mexico, some down into Australia. You can see there we've just put a little bit of a green shading on the countries that we touch with our product, but our primary markets being South Korea, Mexico, being probably number two on as far as disposition of product. We don't move much product into the United States, the West Coast, due to Jones Act restrictions. We maybe put one barge a year down into the West Coast of the U.S., but we really don't have access. There are no vessels in the world that are Jones Act qualified that can carry ammonia. So really our product is destined for the export market as a result of that.
Go ahead.
I mentioned we'd had some challenges recently. Gas availability in the inlet has been a real challenge for us. And what you can see here is a chart of the gas consumption. The Cook Inlet, the demand on that system is around 200 BCF annually. Our facility at full rates consumes 53 BCF of gas. Our neighbors, the LNG facility, have a capacity for approximately 80 BCF of gas. And then between the power generation and the utility market, that's another roughly 70 BCF. What we're seeing since 2001, as you can see, is the last year we ran at capacity as a complex. We're seeing a severe decline in the availability of gas in the Cook Inlet, to the point that, as you can see, that 2002 through 2005, the facility throughput has been reduced significantly, to the point that in November of last year, we shut down half of our facility. We don't believe there's an opportunity to restart that half of the facility on natural gas. In the last 3 years, the employment of our facility has gone from 295 to roughly 160 currently as a result of running only half of the plant. 2006, as you can see, we're anticipating running only half of the facility, and so our forecast on gas consumption is roughly half of the capacity of the facility. Right now, the situation our facility is in is that we have gas contracts through October of this year. We have no gas contracts to support production beyond that, although we're currently in an RFP process trying to secure gas beyond that. We're working with all of the producers to try and get an extension on the commercial life of our facility. The reality is right now that is a difficult proposition for us because the decline continues in the Cook Inlet, and as a result, we've really been looking to alternatives to try and keep this facility alive. Agrium is one of the largest producers of ag nutrients in the world, and this is a key component of our portfolio of production facilities. Go ahead. Mention that we're a significant exporter. You can see here just a fertilizer sales graph from our facility, and you can also see that started in 2002, the significant decline we've seen as a result. And we're anticipating if we had put a projection for 2006, it would be reflective of the gas line you saw. So it's a significant economic impact on the Kenai Peninsula and Alaska overall as we start to lose this business. As we've looked at alternatives, and I know you've seen this, and you've you've heard of the concept overall, but we thought we'd put this slide up here to just demonstrate the proximity of the opportunities. You can see there with the yellow dot is the Agrium facility in North Kenai. And in Tionic, just outside Tionic, is the Beluga coal field that we've been, as a state, attempting to look for a commercial opportunity for some years now. Nothing to date has allowed the opening up of that resource. We also have significant issues with declining oil reserves, the oil production in the Cook Inlet. And you can see those in orange, the Middle Ground Shoals and the Swanson River being two closest to our plant. So the overlay that as we've started to look at this is that there is commercially proven technology that will convert coal into feedstock for a complex like ours. There is one of the byproducts off of that complex is a significant amount of carbon dioxide, which initial indications show could potentially allow recovery of an incremental 300 million barrels of oil in the Cook Inlet with CO2 flood technology. We're at very preliminary stages of evaluating that, but the Department of Energy has been doing significant work to better understand that. Yes?
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. Did you want to take questions during the
time? Probably should right during the
time. Right, sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
So I'm very interested in your project. I'm told that coal gasification, which this is, correct?
That's correct.
That that they're very expensive plants to build, maybe $1 billion?
North of $1 billion.
And that a limited number of them will be permitted in U.S. in the near term. Is that true?
Permitting-wise, if you're speaking to environmental permits, these plants are very clean.
No, it's not the it's not the problem of them being clean. It's just this new technology on this scale that I understood that the federal government was not going to allow many of them to get built until two or three had been built and run effectively, but I'm ignorant. Tell me.
What's happening with the federal government is there's significant incentive in the energy policy National Energy Policy to employ this technology. They're trying to encourage the use of alternate feedstocks, specifically targeting coal, and industrial gasification, and then also the utilization of gasification for power generation is something that's being encouraged. Now, what they have done is they, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on the federal government and the funding mechanisms, but they have made funds available for grant support for these, but it's limited. And so we are not looking they're talking a significant amount of money that's going to be made available for grant support for these facilities, and that really is on a very limited basis. There's one complex that's being evaluated. They're calling it Future Gen, and that's something that the federal government is involved in. We're not really looking to compete with that or for those dollars. There are allowances made for tax credits that we certainly would attempt to take advantage of should this commercial opportunity move forward, specifically aimed at this technology to encourage the development of this, simply because, as you stated, it is very expensive technology. And so you really have to look at how you get your cash flow to support the expenditure.
Senator Dice.
Yeah, so are you figuring that you won't be using coming to us for money to build it?
That's correct.
So you're going to bond it?
What we're looking at right now, we'll just jump to that because it's a very pertinent question. What we've done to date is we've worked with Usabelli Coal Mine, and we did an initial screening study which indicated that this project should move forward, and Usabelli and Agrium jointly funded that study. That was a study we announced at the RDC annual meeting last year, the results of that. At that time, Agrium and Usabelli agreed to fund Agrium the funding of the process complex in Usabelli, the funding of the mine development evaluation, basically the feasibility study, an economic feasibility study. We will complete that within the next month to month and a half. And that study, between the two of our two organizations, will have spent about $4 million to develop the project to that point. What we're trying to do from this point, and where we're at, is, as I mentioned, we're nearing the completion of that work. We will know at the completion of that work if the indication is yes, we should move forward, or no, we should not. But assuming the answer is yes, what we would like to do is create a bankable commercial deal. And when I say bankable, what I'm talking about is firm contracts for the supply of the coal, for the offtake of the fertilizer, for the offtake of the power, and then a lump sum turnkey engineering contract with a process performance guarantee, so that we've really done our best to manage the risks, with a deal that we can then take to Wall Street and finance. And that's really how we're looking to finance this. The challenge we face is raising the funds. That's about a $28 million expenditure to create that package, because to get the lump sum turnkey definition is going to take about $13 million in engineering work. That's the piece of funding we're talking about. What we're saying is this opportunity has to be commercially viable once we create bankable documents.
And the last question, I understand that you'll need an additional electric power intertie to get the 250-350 megawatts you want to sell into the grid. Are you expecting who are you expecting to build the intertie, pay for it?
That's going to be part of our phase two evaluation. What we're doing right now is we're evaluating how much power can we export from this facility. This facility in and of itself consumes 90 megawatts of power, and we don't believe we can get our hands on that easily with the existing grid. Our power is based on some aging generation equipment, and it's fairly expensive. Our initial commercial work, we've hired some folks to help us understand that and understand what would be involved in an intertie, what the costs would be, and what we would have to add if we were to fund that intertie in order to take that power up to the grid. We believe that with the replacement of some of the generation equipment on the peninsula that's higher cost and incremental capacity on the current intertie, we could probably export about 60 megawatts from the facility. The existing southern intertie design that has never been constructed would probably be what we'd be restricted to in the time frame we're discussing, because to design something else and get it permitted by 2011 would be very difficult. If that intertie were to go in, it would allow us to export between 130 and 180 megawatts, depending on what happened with the other production on the peninsula. I don't have an answer for you on how would we fund that intertie. We're anticipating about a half cent a kilowatt hour charge, additional cost to the power, as far as funding that intertie north. But that really has to be part of the further definition we'll do in phase two.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Kent? Go ahead, Tim. Coal supply. And the coal supply, as I mentioned, we've been working with Usabelli Coal Mine. Steve Denton is here. And Steve has really been leading the development of a coal supply plan for this facility. And the analysis to date is to supply most of the coal from Beluga, but also to have incremental capacity coming out of Fairbanks with barge loading and anchorage to support. So we would have barge loading. We're looking at 12,000-ton barges coming from both Beluga and Anchorage, with obviously rail transport from Healy to Anchorage to support that. The technology we're looking at is, as I mentioned earlier, coal gasification and a pulverized coal power plant to support the energy needs. We're looking at some new environmental control technologies on the power plant that allow both CO2 sequestration and environmental performance that competes with the gasification technology. Obviously, gasification is extremely clean. Tim Johnson and I visited the plant in Bougainham that Shell has constructed, and it looks more like an oil refinery than a coal plant. They're look like a petrochemical complex. Incredibly clean and advanced technology that's been developed to allow us to use this energy source. The thing that is somewhat sometimes misunderstood is this plant doesn't produce natural gas. This plant produces carbon dioxide that we convert to hydrogen and CO2, and then we use the nitrogen byproduct of the air separation unit. And our complex would simply take some portion of the carbon dioxide and the nitrogen and combine it into ammonia. And then we would hydrogen and nitrogen and combine to ammonia, and then some of the CO2 to combine with the ammonia to urea. So we would run our facility at full rates, putting in pure feedstocks, which would increase our capacity roughly 20%, and produce all of our ammonia and urea from coal. We would also have significant incremental CO2 available to support an enhanced oil recovery operation in the Cook Inlet. About 7,000 tons a day is our current estimate, and that's not with CO2 recovery off the power plant, which is also technically feasible, which would make significantly more available. As I mentioned, enhanced oil recovery opportunities could be as high as 300 million barrels of crude oil in the Cook Inlet. The power to the grid, you had asked earlier about that, that really is going to be based on economics and the capacity of the interties and whether this power generation can support the economics, the construction of the southern intertie, which we believe that it can. Go ahead. Okay. Direct benefits. As we move forward with this, I think we've really covered a lot of the direct benefits. Obviously, we're talking about a significant employment opportunity. We're down, our facility at full rates, at 300 employees, was estimated to have a direct and indirect employment benefit to the state of roughly 900 positions. This complex, in conjunction with the mine, preliminary rough work indicate that direct and indirect employment of roughly 2,000. So it's a significant employment opportunity. The facilities you see it, that's a picture of our facility with the LNG plant in the background. Our facility is roughly $1.5 billion replacement value if you were to go and try and build our facility today. And that may be a low estimate because of the steel prices and what's happening. We're talking about doubling that facility. So just as you think about what it would it look like, that is sitting on roughly 80 acres as you see it. We would have process equipment on another 80 acres, and that's immediately adjacent to that site. So obviously a pretty significant direct opportunity for Alaska in employment. The other opportunity is, as you know, our natural gas. We're 73%, I believe, is our power dependency on natural gas. And you can tell by what's going on with our facility that a future dependency on natural gas without some significant event like the natural gas pipeline is potentially problematic for the state. That and the fact that a lot of our generation equipment is aging. The challenge we've got is that it's difficult to find the wherewithal to support the construction of a large coal power plant. We're looking at, as part of this project, the power plant component is $600 to $700 million, and that's difficult for within Alaska, with a 900-megawatt grid, that's a difficult expenditure to support. We believe that this project, we have the foundation to establish the coal infrastructure and also an immediate demand for 90 megawatts. We provide the foundation necessary and the economics to support a power plant that we really need in the state. So we really think there's some benefit here. We open the Beluga Reserve. We keep the employment and increase the employment on the peninsula with this processing complex, and we help support what we believe would be the most competitive power in Alaska, and we diversify the energy base in the production of that power by moving away from our dependency on natural gas, which is declining. So really, that's where we're at. I think we already talked to this. We're here. Tim and I are flying to Kansas City next week to meet with the engineering company and review their phase one work. That's being done by Black and Veatch and UDA, which is ThyssenKrupp's engineering arm out of Germany, with the heat material balances being performed by Shell. And we'll be reviewing that next week and ensuring that we can support the work that's been done as we work to construct our final economic evaluation. As I mentioned earlier, that will be complete here within the next 2 to 3 weeks, which will allow us to complete the phase one evaluation and look for funding to initiate phase two. And what we're saying is that we would fund phase two by July, or we would, that's really a litmus test for us. If the opportunity is strong enough, it will be fundable, and we will have the participants and the partners to move forward, or it won't, and we'll continue to our search for natural gas and likely watch our business prepare to wind down on the peninsula. I think that, Tim, did I miss any key points? No. Yes. Oh, thank you, Bob. And this is a point that I almost went right past. We are asking for state support. We're working with Senator Stevens and Senator Murkowski on federal support, and we are asking for state support of phase two. We are out actively talking, and we've done the first round of commercial discussions with people who we think are logical strategic partners for participation in phase two. And we're looking to both the federal government and the state government for some level of support at that level. As we've talked, we're looking at $5 million in phase two funding. Our estimate in phase two is $28 million. The commitment I've told Agrium's senior leadership team would be required from our corporation, and what I've presented to them pending a positive outcome of this phase is that Agrium would be required to provide a significant amount of the funding to phase two, a willingness to contribute the Kenai asset into the new entity that would be set up to hold this entire complex, this entire opportunity, and a willingness to sign a long-term take-or-pay offtake agreement to ensure a market for the product. And we'd be looking for, you know, as I said, a significant commitment. And obviously both Agrium and Isabelle Coal Mine have made a significant commitment to this, the development of this opportunity already.
Senator Elton.
I'm one of the nice things about being on Senate Resources, I'm learning new things. What happens? I mean, if you go to coal gasification, and there is a spur line or there's a bullet line bringing North Slope gas into South Central, are you locked into a higher cost environment because you have gone to coal gasification than you would be in taking gas out of a spur line or a bullet line?
No, in order to move forward with this project, and this is part of our evaluation, we have to ensure that on a coal basis, we're competitive in our markets on the long term. And the real issue, these are very efficient plants. The issue is getting over the capital hurdle of getting them constructed. On a cash basis, they would compete with anybody in the world.
Additional questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Boycott.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming, giving the presentation. You too, Mr. Peterson. Well, I haven't heard you say much yet. Maybe the next time.
Maybe next time.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time. We certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Nothing further. Adjourned to this meeting.